Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for being here. My name is Nick Saychaney. I'm with the Japan Chair here at CSIS, and together with Korea Economic Institute and the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Foundation. It's my pleasure to welcome you to today's session of the Korea-Japan Study Group meeting. I want to acknowledge my colleagues at the outset, Margot Grimm-Yuli from Mansfield and Linda Kim from KEI. And I also wanted to be sure to acknowledge Sarah Yun, who until recently worked with us on the Korea-Japan meeting series at KEI and has since moved on to new challenges, but I want to make sure we thanked her as well. We work together on a series of meetings, about two or three a year, very pleased that we were able to pull this panel together for a very timely session. You have the biographies for all the speakers, so I won't read them back to you. But to my immediate right is Professor Ji Young Lee of the School of International Service at American University. Next to her is Professor Junya Nishino, who's an associate professor at Keio University and currently the Japan scholar at the Wilson Center and also a visiting scholar at the Sigar Center for Asian Studies at George Washington University. And way at the end there, hopefully you can still see him, is Mark Mannion, who is a specialist in Asian affairs at the Congressional Research Service. Each of them will speak for about 15 minutes, and then we'll have a discussion with the audience and wrap it up. So without further ado, thank you very much. Professor Lee, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I am very excited to be here as a part of this timely and important discussion. Many thanks again to the organizers and everyone here for making this happen. You know, I thought I would talk about the incoming Park Geun-hye government and South Korean foreign policy under her leadership. And in doing so, I thought I would start by identifying some of the general trends in U.S. Japan-Korea relations as well as Japan-South Korea relations, basically bilateral and trilateral relations. And then I will think about where these trends might actually be going under this new leaderships. First of all, one of the things that we witnessed in the last 4 years under the Obama administration is this increasing strategic importance of U.S.-ROK alliance in the overall U.S.-Asia policy. Of course, there's no doubt that U.S.-Japan, U.S.-ROK alliances have been the two pillars of U.S. foreign policy towards Asia since the end of the World War II, and with more importance given to U.S.-Japan alliance. There is a new development in the last 4 years or so that U.S.-ROK alliance has been given much more importance, and you hear that South Korea has emerged the closest ally in the eyes of Obama officials. You hear this expression such as U.S.-ROK alliance being the linchpin for regional security. So these are fairly new developments when we think about the history of U.S.-ROK relations. So what we see here is a transformation efforts of U.S.-ROK alliance going beyond the defense of the Korean Peninsula, you know, since the end of the Cold War. Since the end of the Korean War, the structure is going through some transformations. You see the agenda of the alliance. It includes many more issues such as peacekeeping, global health, basically, you know, expanding the scope of the alliance onto the regional and global scope. Then the question is, will this trend continue with this leadership change under the Park Geun-hye and Obama administrations? Well, let's look at what has contributed to this strength in alliance management in the last 4 years. I would say three things. One, Washington and Seoul has similar approaches towards North Korea. Between President Lee and President Obama, they didn't really have many major disagreements over North Korea. And second, the issue of burden sharing. When President Lee Myung-bak, he had a goal known as Global Korea of upgrading South Korean international profile by making greater contributions to, creating international public good. And this went very well with Obama's strategy of updating the existing alliances to share the global burden at the regional and global level. And three, the U.S. rebalancing towards Asia strategy and the importance of U.S.-ROK alliance in that big strategic picture. So from the U.S. perspective, I would say that it is very likely that the Obama administration will continue with its Asia policy in his second term and will continue to expect those commitments and burden sharing from its allies such as South Korea and Japan. From the South Korean side, compared to Moon Jae-in, who was the opposition presidential candidate, you have Park Geun-hye, whose view towards North Korea is much more convergent with that of Obama administration. And her proposed ideas of trust politics makes us predict that there are no fundamental, at least in principle and theory, differences in approaching North Korea. She has expressed, in fact, emphasized deterrence through a strengthened U.S.-ROK alliance as one of the key elements of, her national security policy. She has expressed an interest in, having dialogue with North Korean leaders, and it is very likely that she will try and make a breakthrough in inter-Korean relations once inaugurated. So there may be some initial small hiccups in coordinating this process between Washington and Seoul, but I do think that her basic approach towards U.S.-ROK alliance is that it is a, helping, it is a part of solution rather than an impediment to, inter-Korean cooperation and reconciliation in building the trust that she often talks about. Moving on, second trend is if you actually look at what has really strengthened the trilateral relations between Seoul, Tokyo, Washington, it actually was North Korea. Since the inauguration of President Lee Myung-bak, there were about at least five major occasions where North Korea had shifted regional security dynamics. In 2009, you had missile launch and second nuclear test. 2010, the sinking of South Korean Navy vessel Cheonan. And then you had 2010, the same year, the shelling of Yongpyeong Island. And 2011, the death of North Korean leader Kim Jong-il and enormous amount of uncertainty surrounding his death. And most recently, in 2012, you had North Korea launching missile. So throughout these events, generally speaking, Tokyo has been very quick and very firm in showing Japan's support for South Korean position towards these North Korean provocations together with the United States. So basically, during the Lee Myung-bak government, what you had is Japan's hotline policies coming together with President Lee Myung-bak's own hotline policy, resulting in creating this strengthened relations between these three countries. The failed attempt by Seoul and Tokyo over sharing intelligence on North Korea, it tells us how difficult it is for the two countries to move forward with security relations. But if you think about it, the very fact that they even went so far as to discuss a military pact, it's a testament to the fact that they share similar security interests over North Korea, especially under the Lee Myung-bak government. Then how about the incoming Park Geun-hye government? Well, there was some concern when these, North Korean propagations were taking place. You see some emerging kind of trend in new Cold War in Asia. Beijing relations with these three countries were not necessarily very great because Seoul, Tokyo and Washington will try and put pressure on China to do something about North Korea, but that didn't really, materialize. Under the Park Geun-hye government, there will be more moving parts in South Korea's dealings with North Korea in East Asian security context. What do I mean by this? For one, it appears that Park Geun-hye expects China to play a bigger and constructive role when it comes to its North Korea policy, and it is likely to make that she's going to make greater efforts to improve relations with Beijing. And we already see some of the signs her sending a special envoy to China at the request of the Chinese side. So South Korea under the Park Geun-hye government has an incentive to strengthen U.S.-ROK alliance and to strengthen U.S.-Japan-South Korea relations in a way that those do not appear to counter Chinese national interests. And this is going to be one of the challenges that she's going to have to deal with because it can be difficult when you actually try and do this in practice. So the first real challenge and test for her diplomacy, I think, could come in the aftermath of possible North Korean propagation after her inauguration. Lastly, when it comes to Japan-Korea relations, we have seen this vicious cycle in bilateral relations. Once a new leader from South Korea or Japan comes in, you have these leaders pledging this future-oriented relations, and somewhere down the road, the relations kind of slide into, not so great relations with historical issues over Tokto Takeshima and sex slaves issue. And I don't think Park and Abe administrations are particularly immune to this trend, and they should be careful not to repeat the same mistake of starting off with future-oriented relations only to slide into diplomatic disputes over history later on. If you remember 2006 when Prime Minister Abe came into office, one of the first things that he did was to visit China and South Korea to mend ties with these two countries over Koizumi's visits to Yasukuni Shrine. So, Prime Minister Abe definitely has this pragmatic, approach towards Asian countries. And, we see some of the signs that he's taking similar approaches towards South Korea, if not towards China right now. So for both Park Geun-hye and Abe Shinzo, for them it will be a balancing act. On the one hand, you have your domestic constituencies and your belief about history how things should go forward. On the other, you have pragmatic approach and the need to improve bilateral relations between Tokyo and Seoul for various reasons that they are fully aware. Prime Minister Abe sent a team of special envoy to President-elect Park Geun-hye earlier this month, and we hear that she talked about the importance of building trust in bilateral relations, and she said, I'm talking about the kind of trust that's befitting South Korean public sentiments. So we're going to see how things unfold between the two countries. Let me just share some of the numbers to show where things are in terms of public sentiments in South Korea. This is a survey by Shindonghwa magazine. In a survey of 800 people from September 3rd to 6th, 2012, last year, 79.7% of respondents viewed President Lee Byung-bak's visit to Tokto Takeshima as appropriate. 73.8% wanted Seoul to act more strongly in a territorial dispute with Japan. And 72.2% cast more blame on the Japanese side for ongoing diplomatic disputes. So you can see how there are challenges ahead of both leaders in South Korea and Japan. So to summarize, the key word for Park Geun-hye in her diplomacy and domestic politics as well is trust. She seems to believe that once you know, relationships are built on trust. When difficult circumstances arise, you know, the relationship can stay and remain strong. But when trust is lacking in relationships, even small, tiny things can shake the foundation of that relationship. So we can imagine how once she's inaugurated, she'll be busy building the trust with Japan, North Korea, China, along with other countries, and try and deepen the kind of trust that Seoul and Washington currently enjoys. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please, Professor Nishino, thank you.
Okay, thank you. It's my great pleasure to participate in this session with prominent specialists on today's topic. And also, I also extend my thanks to CSIS, KEI, and the Mansfield Foundation. I'll speak about my perspective on the Korea-Japan relation. This is the weakest link of the trilateral relationship between Japan, Seoul, and Washington. The Prime Minister Abe's most important goals at this point are to carry his party to win the upper house election this summer and to revitalize the long, sluggish Japanese economy. Meanwhile, he has also placed security policy high on his list of priorities and tried to strengthen the U.S.-Japan alliance. Extend security cooperation with other democracies such as Australia and India, as he did in his first term. From Abe's perspective, security cooperation with South Korea will be an important goal of his security policy. However, we know the relationship between the two countries is difficult since last year because President's visit to the islet on August 10 has weighed heavily on the relationship between the two nations. But prior to this incident, Tokyo and Seoul tried to promote security cooperation for several years. For example, defense authorities from both nations signed a memorandum on defense exchange in April 2009, and following the Chonan and the Yeongbyondo incident in 2010, Japanese self-defense force officers for the first time observed subsequently held U.S.-South Korea joint military exercise. Likewise, South Korea military officer observed U.S.-Japan joint military exercise in October of the same year. Moreover, in January 2011, Japan and South Korean defense minister agreed to improve intelligence sharing and logistical support. And last June, both governments were scheduled to sign a bilateral agreement on military intelligence sharing, known as GSOMIA. But as Professor Lee mentioned, just an hour before the ceremony, the South Korean government abruptly pulled out due to rallying domestic criticism over the agreement. That failure and President Lee's subsequent visit to the islet has served as headway made between the two nations in 2009 and 2010, and lessened the chance that the intelligence sharing agreement will be signed in the near future. President Lee's about face surprised Japan and the rest of Japanese distrustful of Lee's government. Many Japanese previously believed that Lee was making big effort to improve Tokyo and Seoul's relationship. Nevertheless, close cooperation with South Korea and the U.S.-Japan allocated trilateralism remain important to Japan. Why? Because major driving forces in this cooperation have gathered momentum and continue to drive forward from the Japanese point of view. Then, what are the driving forces behind the cross cooperation between Japan and Seoul? There are three. First, both governments have made persistent efforts toward improved relations. On Japanese side, the leaders of DPJ expressed great interest in cooperating with South Korea. As evidence of this, Seoul was the first official foreign tour for both Prime Minister Hatoyama and Noda. And also, in 2010, Prime Minister Naoto Kan expressed his apology for the tremendous damage and suffering that the Japanese colonial rule inflicted upon Korea. The year 2010 was 100th anniversary of Japanese annexation of Korea in 1910. Since LDP took power again last month, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has also showed his will to mend strained ties with South Korea. As Professor Lee mentioned, he already sent a positive signal that he would not make Shimane Prefecture's Takeshima Day a national day of recognition, and also he dispatched his envoy, Fukushiro Nukaga, to meet with President-elect Park Geun-hye. Second, growing security concern and unease in East Asia is a strong driving force for security cooperation between two countries. For Japan, addressing the threat posed by North Korea has been the highest security priority since the end of the Cold War. We know the North Korean military provocation, such as the 1998 Tepodo missile launch and 2001 artillery exchange between the North Korean ship and Japanese patrol boats. This kind of thing greatly alarmed Japan to the North Korean threat. Besides this incident, long-range missile program and the nuclear development program, and the uncertainty and secrecy of the new Kim Jong-un regime strongly motivated Japan to share military intelligence with South Korea. At this moment, concerning with China's expanding military activities in the region also pushed Japan to pursue security cooperation with South Korea. Third, we cannot ignore that the U.S. has been promoting Japan and South Korean security cooperation. For example, it was the United States that invited Japanese and South Korean military officers to its bilateral joint military exercise with each nation in 2010. Under the strong pressure of budget cutting in Washington, D.C., the U.S. will continue to make a quiet but strong push for Japan and South Korean security cooperation in order to lessen the financial burden for the regional security. Again, despite the increased tension between Tokyo and Seoul last year, Japan continues to feel pressure for security cooperation with South Korea. That pressure remains high following the tension between Japan and China over the Senkaku Island. Evidence for this is found, for example, in the Yomiuri editorial. On December 29th, Yomiuri's editorials last year, it wrote, quote, "Stabilization of the relation with South Korea is very important for Japan, which has become embroiled in a major row with China over the government purchase of three of the Senkaku Island from a private Japanese citizen," end quote. But the same editorial notes, quote, "The issue between Japan and South Korea of wartime claim for compensation has been fully and finally resolved under the 1965 Treaty for Normalization of Bilateral Relations. The government must steadfastly refrain from an easy compromise over this matter," end quote. This is a position that the Japanese government has been taking. And from the South Korean perspective, this is the main reason for the current tension between Tokyo and Seoul. So, what is the path for Tokyo and Seoul going forward and for the reset of the Japan, Korea, and the U.S. relations? First of all, both sides must be aware of the inflammatory nature of the historical issue and must avoid unnecessarily politicizing them in nationalistic ways. An examination of the recent trend between Tokyo and Seoul's relationship shows that the lack of mutual understanding at the political level has made it difficult to manage this kind of issue with discretion. New Japanese reader must come to understand that due to the long historical memory of South Korean cooperation, South Korean politicians must endure extraordinary political risk when they seek to expand their relationship with Japan. Especially for new President Park Geun-hye, handling the relationship with Japan is a really difficult task because, you know, she is the daughter of Park Chung-hee, whom South Koreans call collaborated with Japan during the colonial period, and because most South Korean media outlets views the Abe cabinet as extremely right, Japanese readers should understand the domestic political situation that their South Korean counterparts are facing. Likewise, South Korean leaders must know the revival of the Japanese militarism cannot happen in today's Japan, and also should learn more about Japan's past efforts on addressing the historical issue. Revitalization of the political network between Tokyo and Seoul and the new administrations at various levels is really necessary to build trust and deepen mutual understanding. From this point of view, it is regrettable that reportedly Prime Minister Abe will not attend the inauguration ceremony of Park Geun-hye next month. I hope Prime Minister Abe and President Park meet at the earliest possible opportunity. Second, Seoul and Tokyo must take greater efforts to share one vision of common regional future. Two countries can play a central role jointly for peace and stability in the region as industrialized democracies. But at the same time, we need to recognize and respect the different perspective in the geopolitical realities in the region. For example, Tokyo is motivated greatly to improve security cooperation with Seoul, in large part due to the uncertainty about China and North Korea. But Seoul does not feel the same level of unease, especially about China. Seoul's fear is that the power struggle between Japan and China will escalate in the regional matter, requiring Seoul involvement. This is exactly that Professor Lee mentioned. In addition, for South Koreans, China is an important stakeholder in the future of the Korean Peninsula as an ally and a patron of North Korea, and more importantly, a signatory of the Korean armistice in 1953. In other words, Chinese endorsement is indispensable for the future of the Korean Peninsula and the unification of the Korean Peninsula. To its Seoul's concern, Japan should respect and support Seoul's initiative in the trilateral cooperation among Japan, South Korea, and China. These three countries established the Trilateral Secretariat at Seoul in 2011. I expect this secretariat become one of grounds for deepening the cooperation between Tokyo and Seoul for peace and prosperity in the region. Finally, along the commitment to this kind of trilateral cooperation, Tokyo and Seoul must work closely with Washington, which will enable Japan and South Korean corporations, especially in security field, to function more feasibly and effectively. At the same time, through this consultation with Washington, Tokyo and Seoul must attempt to handle tasks which ensure the security cooperation meets their national interest. Fortunately, Japan and South Korea and the U.S. have been holding trilateral meetings at various levels to facilitate trilateral cooperation. We should develop this framework for better cooperation under the new leadership in the three countries. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Mark, please.
Thanks, Nick, and thanks to you and the other organizers, KEI and the Mansfield Foundation, for sponsoring this. And I should also give a shout-out to Wes Konishi in the front row, who is one of the, I don't know if you were the founder or you were involved in the original Korea-Japan study group many moons ago, I believe. Is that right? Right. Right, exactly. A different era, 10 years ago or so. So it lives on. So, Nick, also, thank you for persisting. Nick has been trying to organize this for, how many years now? I think first we had talked about doing it in March. In early 2011, we were talking about doing it. In fact, we had a date in March that year. But, of course, the earthquake and tsunami kind of preempted that. Then we were talking about doing something in later that year. So in the March time, it's amazing if you look at how all the efforts that Nick has put into organizing this to see how volatile this relationship is between Japan and South Korea. Back in March 2011, it seemed like we were at a high point. You know, Koreans were donating massively to the recovery effort. I mean, millions of dollars that ordinary Koreans raised. Then by the fall of that year, when Nick tried again to get me to talk and to organize this, things had soured quite a bit. And particularly, we had the Seoul Constitutional Court ruling on the comfort women, which was raised here. Later that year, we had a pretty disastrous summit between Prime Minister Noda and President Lee in Kyoto, again, falling apart over the comfort women issue. Then miraculously last spring, when Nick tried again to organize this, and I should say this is all at least on my fault because I wasn't able to commit to it, not Nick's. In the spring, it looked like we'd patch things back together with the GSOMIA, or Intelligence Sharing Agreement, but of course that fell apart again. And then things really hit rock bottom last fall after President Yi's visit to Dokdo, but almost equally as importantly, his comments about the Japanese emperor, which we could talk about later as well. So it's really striking to see how this relationship has really gone through significant ups and downs over the last couple of years. I'm going to really focus on the bilateral Japan-South Korea relationship because I think in terms of a reset, the trilateral relationship, I don't think reset is the wrong verb, perhaps, because I think pretty much it wasn't really interrupted that much despite all the troubles that Japan and South Korea have gone through over the past year. You know, as has been mentioned by both Dr. Lee and Dr. Nishino, I mean, trilateral ad hoc cooperation, particularly over North Korea issues, has continued. And that's largely due, I think, to North Korea's actions, but also, as Dr. Lee said, to the similar visions of the two governments in Seoul and Tokyo. The question always was whether we could raise trilateral relations to the next level. And, of course, that depended, as Dr. Nishino said, upon raising Japan-South Korea relations to the next level. And so I think the question is, will Japan-South Korea relations be reset to a point where we can take it to a level that sort of institutionalizes this, what was ad hoc relations, and allows something bigger to sprout? As I'll talk about at the end of my remarks, I'm skeptical, at least in the near term, about whether that will actually happen. And I think the theme that you're going to hear from all three of us is trust, and the level of trust between the two governments, at least the past two governments, has almost completely evaporated over the last 2 years. From South Korea's point of view, the promise of the DPJ, Minsto, that they were going to deliver something significant on historical issues was just completely unfounded. The DPJ didn't deliver. And the sense of betrayal on the Japanese side, as Dr. Nishino said, is maybe even more profound, that when President Lee went to Dokdo and then made remarks criticizing the emperor, really gratuitous remarks from the Japanese point of view, in other words, unnecessary, here they had the most pro-Japanese president in Seoul that they had in a long time, and even he was criticizing Japan. So the sense of mistrust is really very strong there, to the point where neither government felt like it has a true partner in the other capital. So in that sense, I mean, the fact that we have a change in government in Japan and are about to have one in Tokyo, in Seoul, is maybe a good thing to give an opportunity for a reset. As I'll talk about in more detail later, I think where the relationship goes in the next couple of years depends on three primary factors. The first, as has been mentioned, is North Korea and North Korea's behavior. And the second two are related. It's domestic politics and, most importantly, the amount of leadership Park Geun-hye and Shinzo Abe, Abe Shinzo, want to put on controlling their own domestic forces and overcome domestic opposition to improving relations. I spent the last couple of years as a Council on Foreign Relations Hitachi Fellow looking at Japan-South Korea relations. And I spent time over in Japan based at the National Institute for Defense Studies, or NIDS, also the Japan Center for International Exchange, JCIE, and in Seoul at the East Asia Institute. So I want to give a quick thank you to them. And I could talk, as I have, for an hour on this topic, but let me shorten it by just highlighting some of the key areas of my research that haven't been talked about so much by Dr. Lee and Dr. Nishino. The first is people-to-people ties. The number of people going back and forth between the two countries is pretty staggering. In 2011, the last year from that I've looked at the data, you have over 4.5 million visitors traveling back and forth. That's about 10,000 people a day. I don't know if any of you have been to the new international terminal, relatively new international terminal at Haneda Airport, but it was basically built by the Gimpo to Haneda route that had become so popular. Koreans are the first or second largest source of tourists for Japan. Regularly, and until last year, Japanese represented about 35% to 40% of all foreign visitors going to South Korea. Now Chinese are surpassing Japanese, but that's sort of a more natural state of affairs. Japan is still a very close number two. In terms of economic ties, and Margo, why don't you, if you could fire that up. There's some interesting stories going on here. Of course, these two countries are still very, that startup? Yeah. And if it doesn't, that's okay, I'll manage. The two countries are still very important to each other. South Korea is the number three export market for Japan, the second largest source of Japanese imports. And also for Japan, South Korea is the third largest export market and is regularly in the top 5 to 8 source of imports. There we go. But what's really interesting is if you look at the relative importance of the two countries to each other. So this chart here shows the percentage of South Korean imports and exports that are coming from and going to Japan. And as you can see, the fall off is quite dramatic compared to 15, 20 years ago. Basically, in both categories, it's half what it was. So again, Japan is still quite important to South Korea economically. It's more important to South Korea than South Korea is to Japan. But the trend line is down, so it's really changing quite a bit. And what's going to be quite interesting to watch in the future is to see what happens once the South Korea-EU FTA really starts to kick into effect. I can remember a couple of years ago, or about 3 or 4 years ago, when I was meeting with a South Korean negotiator of the CORUS FTA, and he didn't want to talk about CORUS. He wanted to talk about the CORUS-EU FTA because he said, he was pounding the table. He said, "This will finally enable us to end our dependence upon imports of intermediate goods from Japan." So all the ball bearings and machine tools and whatnot that Japanese export to South Korea, they also are made by a lot of German and Italian competitors. So he was very enthusiastic about this. So I wouldn't be surprised if that blue line starts going down even more in years to come. In contrast, if you look at the story from the Japanese side, two things are noticeable here. First, again, one, the bars are higher for South Korea, okay, or lower for Japan. But also, it's a lot less volatility there. Again, South Korea's importance to Japan has pretty much remained more or less constant over the last 15 years. So that's something that's interesting there. And kind of jump around a little bit, and of course, one of the big issues is Dokdo, Takashima, Liancourt Rocks. Pick your favorite term depending on which country you're in. As you may know, if you go on Wikipedia on this issue, the term that you'll come to depends on what country you're in. If you're in the U.S., if you enter Dokdo in, it will take you to Liancourt Rocks. But if you go to Japan, I will only take you to Takashima. So Wikipedia is sort of exercising some diplomacy. I took a trip to Shimane-ken, the capital, and to the capital there, which is Matsue, the city of Matsue. Has anyone ever been there? Matsue? Yeah. It's a great little city. I highly recommend it. It's a bit hard to get to, but it's really lovely. It's right by these two beautiful lakes. Seafood is great there. But I went, and I lived not far from there about 20 years ago, so this is my third time there. And so I was eager to both go back, but also this time to actually start asking people about Takashima and what their feelings were. So this is where Matsue is. Again, it's a little hard to get to. It's not on any of the main rail lines. And, you know, driving around the city, I saw a grand total of two signs about Takashima. You know, this basically says, and my Japanese is only so-so, but basically it says, you know, return Takashima, you know, the land and the sea around it, and then please visit our Takashima resource room on the second floor. So I went to the Takashima resource room, and this is the only way to get there. And here's the entrance to Takashima resource room. And there's our two islands. You know, when my daughter, my 11-year-old daughter, saw this model, not here, but about 2 weeks later, we were traveling in Seoul, and we were at the Anguk train subway station, and there's almost an identical model, much, much bigger, of course. Koreans have to be bigger. And I said to my daughter, this was about maybe 3 or 4 days after President Lee had been to visit the islands, and I said, this is what they're arguing about. And she looked at them, and she said, it's just a bunch of stupid-looking rocks. And that sort of sums up the American, I apologize to South Koreans, that's sort of the American view of this dispute. So we have one room there, and then here's the other one. So this is the grand sum total of Japanese research on Takashima. And I don't have comparable pictures for what you see when you go into Seoul, but for all of you who I'm sure have been to Seoul and seen all the posters and whatnot about Dokdo, there is just no comparison. And in interviews that I did while in Matsue, it was clear that while, you know, there's a firm belief that Takashima is Japanese and they would continue to promote Takashima Day, there were no plans to expand this, any of these resources, that in a sense this was, I don't want to say it was tatemai going through the motions, but there was a feeling that it was almost that they had to do this to get elected to their to become governor of Shimane or to get elected to the prefectural assembly for various reasons, because of fishing rights, et cetera. Now, I was in Matsue 3 days before President Lee's visit to the islands, and I could say that that completely changed the political dynamic. And I think now, going back to Matsue in a year or so, you'll see a completely different story. It won't just be a dingy little resource room, but there will be lots of money invested here. If I could give a, and to show that, I mean, this is the Shimane Art Museum, which was built about a little over 10 years ago. There's also a terrific new history museum for the city. I mean, the improvements that have been made in Matsue City are just pretty striking. So my point is that there's lots of money here, which was quite surprising to me. And none of it has been going to promote Takashima. So I think that's going to change quite a bit in the future. Okay, so picture time's over. Let me get to, Nick told me, you have to come back to what's going to happen in the big picture. And so let me talk first about the near term and the longer term. The near term, I think it boils down to, as I said, North Korea, domestic politics, and leadership. In terms of Japanese politics, a big change over the last 2 years is that South Korea has become more of a political issue inside Japan, particularly within the LDP. I mean, the primary reason that Abe Shinzo was chosen as head of the LDP, I think, was due to problems with China. But a secondary reason was because this feeling that Japan was just getting beat up by everybody, including South Korea. If you remember, his election came not long after President Lee's trip to Dokdo and his remarks about the emperor. So, you know, if South Koreans are upset that, you know, this supposedly right-wing government has been selected in Japan, you know, in part they have no one but themselves to blame on this. In particular, the Takashima lobby, as I mentioned, has been given a huge boost inside Japan. And most disconcerting is that fewer Japanese thinkers from across the spectrum, foreign policy thinkers, they're just not willing to make South Korea a priority anymore because they feel like, look, we've tried some things, but they've been rejected, and we really don't have any partners who we can work with in South Korea. In terms of South Korean domestic politics, I don't think I need to go into details because it already has been about how risky it is to have any big initiatives with Japan. We saw that with the intelligence sharing agreement. The added factor here is that Park Geun-hye is quite vulnerable on Japanese issues because her father is seen as signing a very pro-Japanese normalization treaty back in 1965. So that will make it especially difficult for her to take steps. So really we have two questions, as I put up at the outset. The question is, are the two governments going to be able to sort of take relations to the next level? For the reasons I've just laid out, I think it's very doubtful, at least in the next year or so. Then the other set of questions is, are things going to get worse? And inevitably, there are going to be issues that come up, even if they're not raised by the two governments. Some, you know, Japanese politician is going to, and perhaps even in the cabinet, is going to make a statement, or perhaps some South Korean civil society group will take steps on Dokdo, that it's going to create some sort of crisis in the bilateral relationship. Another area to watch for is the textbook issue with Japan, and I won't talk about that now, but maybe we could save that for questions. And I think the key thing to look for is whether the leadership on the two sides are able to really work to contain and manage the crisis that comes up and keep it as, number one, as a mini crisis rather than a big one, and secondly and relatedly, whether that crisis is going to spill over and affect other areas in the relationship. For the first 4 years of his presidency, President Lee worked very hard to do this. And whenever there was some issue that came up, whether it was Japanese textbooks claiming Takashima or the defense ministry's white paper mentioning Takashima, the Blue House would often send people out to talk to the press and saying, look, we shouldn't overreact. Japan's an important country. Yes, we're upset by this, but you know we have to focus on the big picture. What changed is over the last year is that the Blue House became much less willing and able to do that. So it's a key question as to whether Park Geun-hye is going to be willing to exert her authority as well. What's equally problematic is now we have the same set of issues going on the Japanese side. Because, as I said before, South Korea has become much more of a political issue in Japan. So I think what we can expect going forward is that the most we can expect is that the two governments will be able to try contain these mini crises that go up. And I think I could say more, but I think, Nick, am I running up against time here? Yeah, okay. So I could talk more in detail about North Korea and going beyond management and where we could take things to the next level, but why don't I shut up and just say that I think over the next year, certainly, and probably the next 5 years, this is going to continue to be a highly volatile relationship that's very vulnerable to domestic political events. And it's going to be difficult for leaders on both sides, even if they wanted to try and contain things. And perhaps the only saving grace might be North Korea.
Thank you, all three, very much. Of course, want to give all of you a chance to chime in here in a minute, but I just thought I'd ask each of you a brief question reflecting on your remarks. If I could start with Professor Lee, you mentioned the issue of trust and trust politique, I believe is the phrase that you used. I'm just curious how you evaluate Prime Minister Abe's approach to the ROK-Japan relationship since he assumed office. I mean, there was a lot of media coverage in the lead up to the election in Japan and about what he would do and the prospects for a tougher stance on various issues that tend to complicate the Japan-ROK relationship. My view is that the approach has been rather pragmatic thus far, and I'm wondering what your perspective is and how long you think that might last. For Professor Nishino, you didn't say this explicitly, but what I took away from your remarks was that how important perceptions are in Japan ROK relations, and I was just wondering how you think the dialogue in Japan about ROK-Japan relations might evolve if the Park government starts to pursue dialogue with North Korea and continue outreach to China, which, as you noted, is, from a South Korean perspective, very important, but that might not necessarily resonate with people in Japan. So I'm just wondering, from the Japanese perspective, how you think South Korea's outreach to North Korea and China might impact the bilateral relationship. And for Mark, I'm going to keep it very simple and ask you to answer the point that you didn't get to, which is, I think we have North Korea to thank in many ways, ironically, for the degree of U.S.-Japan ROK trilateral coordination. But I want you to elaborate a little bit more on how you see things over the long term. And what it's going to take for the trilateral dialogue to sustain its intensity. So each of you, please, we'll start with Professor Lee briefly. Thank you.
So how Prime Minister Abe is going to approach towards Japan-ROK relations, right? I think Prime Minister Abe understands the strategic importance of keeping good relations with Seoul. Especially with regards to the rivalry between Tokyo and Beijing right now. So it is, I can see, at least on my part, him trying to, hoping that South Korea supports Japan's cause rather than Beijing. So, the recent, gestures that he has made regarding the, decide to hold off the Takeshima Day event and the fact that he sent envoys to President-elect Park Geun-hye, he definitely has that pragmatic side, with this understanding that South Korean diplomatic support for Beijing, not for Beijing, for Tokyo will be important for him, in his dealings with China. So, I think to Prime Minister Abe, China is more immediate concern rather than South Korea, and it's great if South Korea supports, Japan as opposed to, China, if that rivalry structure was going to be, kind of South Korea in between, Beijing and Tokyo, right? So, Prime Minister Abe will be interested in kind of in getting the support from Seoul. Having said that, if you think about some of the prime ministers in recent Japanese politics, Prime Minister Fukuda or Prime Minister Hatoyama, even with their emphasis and attempts to have these friendly relations with South Korea, it's been very difficult. When relations are good, you hear the agenda of giving voting rights, granting voting rights to South Korean nationals in Japan. Those things will pump up only when the relations are great, because South Korean government is interested in pushing those agenda forward. I don't think, in the current circumstances, those are not going to be even on the surface. And Prime Minister Abe, the nature of his agenda, relatively speaking, it's nationalistic, even compared to those, prime ministers who wanted to improve the relations. So, I tend to agree with Mark that this is, you know, to begin with, very volatile type of relationship. And remember, you know, I used to write CSIS compare connections after the first, you know, quarter talking about Abyss, you know, coming to power, and then the next quarter, honeymoon is over, you know, over, you know, sex slave issues. So there are many kind of parts that looks very kind of risky, you know, his take on, you know, possibility of, you know, taking steps backward about the Kono statement and you know, all that kind of historical issues. So strategically, I think Abe, Prime Minister Abe would like South Korea to, you know, support Japan, but, you know, when you bring all the domestic politics and his own views on where Japan should go and its, you know, relations with China will, you know, make things difficult for him to really, you know, exert the kind of political leadership that Mark has just talked about.
Thank you. Professor Lee, as Professor Lee mentioned, Prime Minister Abe, in his first time, tried to establish a strategic and mutual beneficial relationship with China in 2006. And 2 years, 2 years later, Prime Minister Fukuda, at that time, agreed a sort of joint development and around the East China Sea, around the Senkaku in 2008. But now situation is totally dramatically changed. So it is difficult for Prime Minister Abe to mend the relationship with China at this point. And for Prime Minister Abe and Abe cabinet, I think he is very carefully watching the South Korean approach towards China. And but I think basically Japanese government should understand and respect South Koreans' policy toward China, as I mentioned in my remarks. And as for North Korea, I also think Prime Minister Abe is carefully watching South Korean government policy toward North Korea. But as far as I know, now President-elect Park is really cautious her policy toward North Korea, and maybe for her, it's really difficult to reopen the dialogue with North Korea and to lift the sanction after the Chonan incident, so-called 524 measures sanction. But for Abe, if South Korean government New South Korean government tried to reopen the dialogue, it is the good opportunity for Abe to engage North, because, so you know, this is Abe that post-sanctioned on North Korea, but now we Japanese know this kind of sanctions have not worked well. So now we are thinking we need an engagement or a dialogue with North Korea. And maybe Abe is cautiously thinking about this kind of thing. If he success the opening dialogue with North Korea, this is a very, really good achievement for Abe government. And if this will come before this coming election, this is really a good achievement for Abe to win the election this coming this summer. So I think at this moment, everyone think Abe is really hawkish, and he will try to continue pose sanction on North Korea, but I hope Abe will try to reopen the dialogue with North Korea, and this is a good chance if President Park try to reopen the dialogue with North Korea.
let me sort of look forward in time, Nick, and then come back to the present and also address some of the other issues that you, questions that you had. You know, long-term, assuming status quo on the Korean Peninsula, which is a big assumption, you know, looking out over the coming decades, you know, it's very easy to see these two countries, which are so similar in so many ways, you know, particularly structurally, you know, converging on a whole range of issues. I mean, you have two very similarly economically structured societies that are aging in roughly the same way. They have a lot to share and learn from each other. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point over the next century, let's say, if you have a much deeper integration economically, culturally, you know, having joint education institutions, for example, where students could, you know, take courses in each other's, in both countries, et cetera. You know, that's one point. Secondly is that there are many more fora that are around now, both internationally and regionally, where the shared interests will bring the two countries together. The East Asia Summit is one of them. We haven't talked about the trilateral Japan-China, South Korea free trade agreement, which probably will be launched officially later this year. You know, and this isn't even talking about North Korea issues. So there are lots of issues that where the convergence of interests will be highlighted. But I think that my sense is, and this I don't have anything really to point to, any data on this, but this, that the romance has been lost. There was a feeling that in 2009, with the election of the DPJ, that this was a golden opportunity, that you had two governments that really are able to and willing to bring the relationship to another level, and that's failed. So maybe there's a more of a sense of realism now, both sides and also here in Washington, about how what the potential is really, and it's a lot less than maybe we thought it was. And that may not be such a bad thing to have a dose of reality. So, you know, South Korea and Japan probably are never going to be like France and Germany. But they're also not going to be like Turkey and Armenia either. You know, there's sort of a, you know, a halfway spot, and they're probably closer to France and Germany than they are to Turkey and Armenia, fortunately. In the medium, you know, in the more close term, I think there are some issues that, in some ways, that the U.S. can play to help bring the two countries together. Certainly, convening any sort of trilateral coordination is helpful. That's a lot easier, in particular for the South Koreans, to be seen as cooperating. The Chinese actually can play a role here. As I mentioned, you have the CJK FTA, ironically. And also, you know, on a lot of other issues, it will be interesting to see if South Korea can, what South Korea does. For example, Park Geun-hye has talked about a Northeast Asian peace and cooperation initiative. You know, might there be a mediating role that her government could play on the Senkaku's issue, for example? I know that would be difficult because of the Dokdo Takashima case, but perhaps there's some way that she can step in and help things out as well. So, you know, I think maybe having a stronger dose of reality, but within that, there are still areas that the two countries can come together, particularly not in a bilateral setting, but in a multi or trilateral setting.
All right, thank you. Well, let's turn to you all in the time we have remaining. If you could just help us out by identifying yourselves and your affiliations and ask your question in the form of a question, to be blunt. Thank you. Sure. Larry. And
the latest issue of The Economist, the lead editorial, begins, China and Japan are sliding toward war. And certainly this is what the Chinese media is talking about, from everything that I have been reading about the Chinese media and what has been saying about the Senkakus. Now, I have been told that in South Korea, There is considerable pro-China sentiment about the Senkakus. So my question is, how pronounced in South Korea is this pro-China sentiment with regard to the Senkakus Daidai dispute? Secondly, does China have some sort of campaign going in South Korea to develop and increase sentiment sympathetic toward China with regard to the Senkakus? And finally, if all of this builds in South Korea, how should President Park handle it? Should she kind of go along with it and let her government go along with it like Nomo-hyun did in 2005 with Takashima Day? Or should she try to contain it or turn it back? How serious is the Senkakus in terms of a possible really divisive issue between Japan and South Korea?
And Tiaryu Island disputes is a frequent, you know, makes a frequent headlines in South Korean dailies as well. I don't know if I'm able to fully answer your question in terms of the degree to which there's a pro-China sentiment in South Korea. Just generally speaking, you know, when you look at these questions of Senkaku and Daidai Island disputes, you know, you in South Korean psyche, you go back to you know, the past history you know, with Japan. So in that sense, I think, you know, I don't know, I don't have any data, I apologize, but you know, there's that kind of lumping the Senkaku and Daegu Island disputes together with Tokto Takeshima. You know, when you point the finger at Japan, look, it's not just us. Japan has troubles with China too. You know, that kind of sentiment, I think it is there, you know, when you hear, when you read editorials and whatnot. Regards to does China have any ways or mechanism to develop pro-China sentiments regarding the Senkakus and Daidai Island disputes? I actually not know if they have any specific actions, but I know, especially in the beginning of a new government, you know, you can go back to, you know, President Lee coming to power, you know, you can actually see this, you know, kind of diplomatic offensive coming from, you know, Chinese side to enhance, you know, South Korea-China relations, strategic, you know, cooperative partnership. You know, those words, you know, did not really materialize throughout Lee Myung-bak government, and I understand that there were, you know, disappointments on the part of China regarding the state of, you know, South Korea's relations with China and South Korea's relations with the United States. But if you can look, if you see what's going on between Beijing and Seoul right now, you know, Chinese, it was actually Chinese who requested that South Korea send the envoys to China, and you know it is said that you know, President like Park Geun-hye had Kwanshi, the kind of interpersonal relationships with Chinese leaders. She has met with you know, Xi Jinping and other Chinese top leaders, and she speaks some Chinese. I don't know how fluent, but you know, the episode that she says that she was interpreting, you know, between South Korean government official and Chinese officials, you know, so and those have been taken very, you know, nicely, warmly by the Chinese side. So I'm not so sure about the Senkaku Daidai Island disputes, but I am aware that Chinese are very much looking forward to, you know, Park Geun-hye having much friendlier policy towards China this time, because there were sentiments of disappointments with regards to Lee Myung-bak government. And, you know, if you look at editorials in Global Times and whatnot, you know, they talk about how, you know, South Korea should have more balanced approach and, you know, and should pay more attention to Beijing, you know. So there's that diplomatic charm offensive kind of, you know, thing going on. But it's not just because it's Park Geun-hye, you know, they've done that with Lee Myung-bak, you know, they do that. It's their way of being pragmatic when it comes to Korean Peninsula. But it looks like there's some sentiments that we're glad that it's Park Geun-hye because we have Kwanzi type of, you know. And Park Geun-hye seems to be, you know, seems to think that China, you know, is a very important player in the future of the Korean Peninsula. I mean, any Korean leader would do. And at least the start seems to be smooth between the two capitals. Whether Park Geun-hye is going to handle this question like President Roh Moo-hyun had done, I do not think so. You know, if you actually look at the presidential debate between, you know, Park Geun-hye and Moon Jae-in, it was exactly that question that Park Geun-hye has asked to Moon Jae-in: are you going to repeat the same, you know, mistake that brought, you know, damages to our national security interest, the so-called balancer idea? That I don't think that's where she's going to go. She's been very clear that, you know, what she's interested in is South Korean national interest and South Korean sovereignty and dignity, not to, and it doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, and it doesn't mean that she has, you know, China-leaning or, you know, Japan-leaning kind of special type policy. And my sense is that she will try and really implement the kind of policy that, you know, U.S.-RK alliance is at its best and U.S.-China relations, you know, improve significantly. And she has, you know, said clearly that she does not see South Korean relations with China, South Korean relations with the United States in zero-sum term. She doesn't think that. And she thinks it's possible to have good relations with both countries. And I think if she could do that, you know, that's going to be a real kind of diplomatic skills that she has been really emphasizing, that the question of trust. So, you know, if there's an element between Seoul and Beijing, you know, the way that Chinese diplomats and policy works, you know, the importance of interpersonal relationship at the higher level, I think she will probably be someone who understands that. Yeah.
Mark and then
Two quick points. One, first, I think you see contradictory trends in Seoul on this. You know, on the one hand, at least at the elite level, I detect almost a growing anti-Chinese feeling in Seoul in some quarters. I mean, in particular, the incidents with the Coast Guard, you know, attacks on South Korean Coast Guard by Chinese fishermen is really rankles the South Koreans. On the senkakus, I think it really depends on the narrative about Japan, both on two things. One, how events develop, and then secondly, on the narrative about Japan. I've noticed a big difference in how South Korean media are treating the Senkaku incidents this time around compared with 2010, whereas in 2010, they were very sort of pro-Japanese, if you will, or taking Japan's side. Now, it's been much more ambiguous, at least in my sense, and I think a big reason for that is because South Korean Japan relations declined last summer, and then now you've had the Abe government come in, which the South Koreans are convinced means that they're going to relaunch an invasion of South Korea, of the Korean Peninsula. I'm exaggerating, of course, but so I think that's one reason why you detect this difference here. But you know, as to your direct question, the answer is I'm not sure, Larry, but I do think you do have this battle between these two contradictory feelings.
Fortunately, Park Geun-hye and her foreign policy advisors always emphasize and assert this stronger alliance with the United States. But maybe first test for Park Geun-hye administration is a negotiation on the nuclear agreement and defense costs with the United States. So if these negotiations raise the national sentiment of South Koreans, this will give an impact not only the relationship with the United States, but also the total structure of the Northeast Asia, especially the relationship with China.
Okay. Bernard Gordon, University of New Hampshire. Mark put on the board the only direct reference to trade. And the United States has identified the Trans-Pacific Partnership as the single most important trade initiative of the Obama administration. At the same time, I think it's evident that there's a good bit of dissatisfaction with the pace of Japan's involvement. And people are suggesting and have suggested for the past 2 or 3 years that the only thing that could get Japan to act quickly with regard to TPP is a decision on the part of Seoul to join. The Korean reaction has always been, well, we've been so busy with Chorus, we can't pay attention to anything like that. But now the European relationship has picked up. So my question essentially to all three of you is it likely or in any sense realistically possible that a decision by Korea could in fact move the Japanese to join the TPP? Because without Japan's participation, the TPP is really not worth thinking very seriously about. Thank you.
Yeah, Bernie, you know, Japan's decision to join sort of was kickstarted in fall of 2010 by Prime Minister Khan, you know, and he kept saying, if the Koreans could do it, why can't we? You know, if Korea can't, why can't Japan? So clearly there was a bit of one-upsmanship. And then once he made the decision to start flirting with the idea of joining, that's in part what gave the Koreans some motivation to, you know, make some concessions on the Chorus FTA. So there clearly was some, you know, competitive liberalization going on at the time. Having said that, though, I think that Japan's decision really is much more determined by domestic politics. And I wouldn't be surprised right now the name of the game is the upper house elections in July. And the true test of where the Abe government wants to go with this will come after that. He would be foolish to do anything on TPP, even utter the word TPP, before those elections, based on their past experience. You know, from South Korea's point of view, you know, what does TPP offer them? I mean, you know, they have FTAs with just about everybody who's in the negotiation now. It might upset China. They've got a lot of other things going on, so I wouldn't, while I have no direct knowledge of where they're likely to go, I'd be surprised if they jumped in right away. I think they're probably going to be more cautious and put more priority on the China-South Korea FTA and perhaps the trilateral China-South Korea-Japan FTA first, and then step back and take a look at TPP.
Yeah, I totally agree with Mr. Manin. So for Abe, it is difficult to start join the TPP negotiation before the winning the election, upper house election this summer. If he wins the election, he can push his agenda for next 3 years. But if he lost, it's very difficult to handle this kind of issue.
Thank you. Add that TPP by some in South Korea is viewed as a step that counter Chinese growing influence by the United States. So it, you know, TPP is not, you know, like in the center of public debate or anything, but when people, you know, make reference to TPP, you know, there is a view, you know, that exists within South Korea, that TPP as a tool on the part of the United States to counter growing Chinese influences. So I will kind of second what Mark had to just say, that there's the security and political implication of joining this partnership. So I don't think it's going to become a big issue, imminent issue that South Korean government will have to face, would like to face in the near future.
Weston Kanishi, IFPA. Every now and then you hear the U.S. should get more involved in moderating disputes between Japan and South Korea. And I'm wondering whether what the panel thinks about those kind of discussions and debates, and whether you think it's really dangerous for the U.S. to step in something that's so heated as this kind of a dispute.
Wes, I was nice to you. I said good things about you, and you asked the hard question. Right, exactly. You know, I sort of go back and forth. I'm of two minds on this issue. I mean, sometimes I think, yes, absolutely, we should play a bigger role. I mean, Larry Nixon and I have had this conversation, and, you know, he's brought up the point, for example, on Dr. Takashima. You know, first of all, we played a role in that dispute in a couple of ways. Historically. Secondly, you know, what happens if resources, undersea resources, are ever discovered there? Then all of a sudden, you could have a Senkaku Diaoyu situation flaring up. Maybe we should play a bigger role. On the other hand, it's really hard to see how we do it without making things worse, and B, whether we, even if we could figure out, okay, here's the magic button or the magic formula, if we're skilled enough to do that, I'm not sure. So maybe the best way to do it is to be sort of like instead of playing a mediating role, to be like a line judge, in a soccer game, where if either side sort of gets out of bounds, then we sort of raise a flag, and even if we do it privately, or publicly if need be. So, and that's basically the role we've been playing, in communicating to the Abe government, okay, you know, if you take these steps, on historical issues, if you rewrite the Kono statement, for example, this will create big problems in the relationship. And likewise, we might be doing the same thing with the Park Geun-hye government on Dokdo. You know, don't go to Dokdo, because that will create problems. So in that sense, being a line judge may be perhaps the best and most appropriate way to be if either side goes out off the field.
Same sentiments. I thought when Michael Honda had House Resolution 121, when things go just out of the boundary, management, I think that's perhaps from the U.S. perspective, it's the way to go. Basically, because you have two allies, you probably don't really want to take sides, right? So that's what I would say for now. If not at the government level, track to diplomacy, CSIS can play a great role, KEI and Mansfield Foundation, in, by socializing with policymakers and younger generation, future generation policymakers, just really educating the importance of, communicating and all that nice socializing thing.
Can I add real quick? Oh, sorry, go ahead. Could you? Dozo.
Yeah, I think the U.S. Continue to action, not taking side. This is the right judgment. And from this perspective, I was pretty surprised that Secretary Clinton's statement after the foreign minister meeting with Kishida. She used a sort of strong word on Chinese activity. But basically, the U.S. Position will be kept. Japan got a good statement from Secretary Clinton, so it's enough for me. At this point,
the U.S. put a lot of pressure on South Korea on the intelligence sharing agreement, and that sort of backfired. And likewise, the U.S. was leaning heavily on Japan on the cover women issue. And actually, there was a lot of potential there, but unfortunately, the two sides were actually somewhat close on that, but unfortunately, that didn't pan out. But just to follow on, to emphasize what Dr. Lee was saying, I think in addition to track two issues, trying to get South Korea and Japan to cooperate in out-of-area operations militarily or diplomatically, South Korea is not very active in Southeast Asia, for example. To get ODA cooperation, there are a lot of out-of-area things that we probably could be doing that might not trip the sensitivity, that the two countries might not do on their own, but also might not trigger the tripwires that often could happen, like we saw with the intelligence sharing deal.
Great. Well, thank you. We're just about out of time. I thought very briefly I would just reiterate some of the themes we heard today. With respect to ROK-Japan relations, there were a number of key words to build off of Professor Lee's presentation that we heard. One is trust and what it's going to take for the ROK in Japan to build it, and how perhaps the Park and Abe governments are going to have to engage in some sort of balancing act, understanding the strategic importance of the bilateral relationship, but having to work through complicated political issues. We also heard a somewhat pessimistic view about whether or not we should be more realistic about the prospects for enhanced ROK Japan cooperation going forward, precisely because of the issues that we heard about today that are so complex and constantly get addressed in the domestic political context of the two countries. On the other hand, we also heard how ROK and Japan have shared interests. Mark used the term converging interests. They're both close alliance partners of the United States as the U.S. is further developing its own strategy to rebalance its diplomatic attention on the region. There's a great degree of trilateral coordination, primarily on security issues, and that is likely to continue. So I just wanted to conclude on a little more optimistic note, and that perhaps while there are a lot of challenges in the near term that need to be sorted through, that the U.S. will likely continue to emphasize the shared interests that the United States and the shared interests that Japan and the ROK share, and that that helps form a vision for the future of the region that will facilitate a dialogue over the long term. So I think perhaps there's room for some optimism there. But we shall see. Should be an exciting year. And we'll try to continue to monitor these issues in the context of this forum. But I'm sure everyone in Washington will be doing so as well. So thank you, and please join me in thanking our speakers.